When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
What began as a vacation ended as a nightmare.
Boils and ghouls, lock your doors and strap yourselves in. From Los Angeles, California, Bloody Disgusting presents the Boo Crew Podcast. Horror news, commentary, reviews, interviews, and more. With your hosts, Lauren and Trevor Shand and Leone D'Antonio.
Hey. I'm Lauren.
I'm Trevor, and we are two-thirds of your Boo Crew, your weekly celebration of horror and the people that love it. That would be you. You are the person that loves it. Leo, where's Leo?
Leo is not present.
He's on a Boo Crew mission in Kilkenny, Ireland.
What?
Yeah, he's on a sabbatical in Kilkenny, Ireland.
Really?
And we hope that he's back with some new horror from over out that way. And he'll be back probably, I think, in 3 weeks, is the last I had heard.
This is the first I've heard.
He's working on a farm out there.
Doing what?
You know, he got a job on a farm out there.
These are rumors.
Highly rumored, but very, I could confirm them pretty quickly.
No,
we don't know where he is tonight.
Yeah,
I have a theory, though.
Clue.
I think he's seeing Saw X without us.
No.
I think there's a really good chance he's seeing Saw X. Like, this late at night, if you're busy, you're probably at a movie, right?
Yes.
11:25, you're not eating dinner, right?
No.
You gotta be in a movie. Or you're at, like, Knott's Scary Farm, but I don't even think Knott's is open on Monday, is it? I don't think many of the haunted attractions are open Monday, I don't think.
No.
I could be wrong, but I don't think Horror Nights is open.
Not yet. So, doesn't it open later in the season, earlier?
So, yeah, I think he's at Saw X, which I really want to see.
I want to see it, too.
And it's playing in 4DX. Oh, Saw X in 4DX. That's a lot of Saw.
Like, I wonder if the chairs, like, trap you. Like, what do they do?
I don't know.
Be crazy.
I mean, the amount of blood water that shoots your way, because, you know, anyone who hasn't been in a 4DX theater, it's that the chairs are loaded with smells, movement, and water somehow comes out of them. I don't know where they come out. Do they come out of the chairs in front of you? I don't know where the water comes from.
No.
It's pretty amazing that it doesn't, like, get in your popcorn either. It's, like, really well placed. But I really want to see it in 4DX. And that was directed by Kevin Grutert. I think that's how to say his name. He's a rock star editor, and he's been editing Saw movies since the first one. This is his seventh that he's edited. And he's directing this one, and he's also edited The Strangers and Cobweb most recently, and he also worked on James Cameron's Titanic.
Wow.
Yeah, so you're in good hands with Saw X. This week on the episode, what do we got here? Coming up in a bit, we got writer-director Juan Salas, who stops by to tell you about his new wild slasher flick, House of Dolls, on VOD Digital and select theaters as we speak. First of all, there's so much going on for spooky season in terms of movies, events, haunted attractions, immersive experiences. The list goes on. We checked out some things that we got excited about, wanted to pass them along to you real quickly before we get on to that conversation with Juan. Where should we start? Experiences. We went in the Universal Halloween Horror Nights out here.
That was so fun.
What did you think of it compared to other years?
I mean, I really liked it for a few reasons, and this would just be personal reasons, not anything that anybody else would experience. Mm-hmm. But last time, the sitter had to leave early, so I had to leave early. I think that was the last time.
Yeah, that was.
And I was really bummed that I missed out on a lot of mazes.
And the thing is, what they've done on Universal the past few years with that addition of that mid lot, it's kind of in between the upper and lower. You kind of walk outside the park around the Harry Potter attraction, and you walk down this long sort of almost like behind parking structures, I think. I don't know what it is, but you're out there in the ether, and you make this long processional down to where Child's Play and Universal Monsters Unmasked, I think it was called this year, those mazes were. And that kills a lot of time.
Yes, that is a time suck.
And there is a lot of those instances where you're walking down the escalators at Universal.
My gosh.
Didn't we time them once? It's like 15 or 20 minutes just to get down all the all the escalators.
Forever.
Right. So there's a lot of walking there. So, you know, although there may be, you know, I don't know, 8 or 9 mazes or whatever there is, feels like about that amount. But you think you'd be able to nail each one very quickly, relatively quickly, if you had like a front of line pass or whatever, if you shelled out for that. But with all that walking in between, that night gets really long and really late. So
it
does. You were screwed out of quite a bit of mazes last year. So
I really was.
We planned in advance. We're able to get this sitter to stay as late as she could. And we went and basically went to every single maze.
It was so fun.
I will say, though, I will say this year, my only gripe is the customer experience. I think that the event is being oversold. And usually, like, we shell out for the, we splurge on the front of line pass.
Which is not cheap.
Which is not cheap at all. So that's a big deal for us. So when we go and do this, and we do this, you know, once a year, save up, splurge on Halloween Horror Nights. This is the first time that we've ever waited in pretty long line. I think we waited in an hour long line in front of line.
For Chucky, yeah.
Yeah, for Chucky. There was a couple mazes where it was pretty long.
So what was the non-front of line like?
I think the longest was 180 minutes, according to the app.
How many hours is that? Where's Leo with his freaking math?
Well, 60 minutes in an hour or two would be... Hold on. Like, we are so stupid when it comes to math.
Oh, yeah.
180, 60, 3 hours.
Three.
I guess
hours.
That's pretty obvious. Everybody's like, you idiots.
Yeah.
You idiots.
Yeah. It's exactly like what they can't forget. How did they
we're
pass
the
high school?
We're the worst.
Like, how did they get through elementary?
Screaming. You guys are idiots.
Okay. Listen, we have been up so early with like 4 kids.
Oh, yeah,
my brain is just fried.
Hey, our brains are always fried. Even if we weren't that, we still wouldn't know.
I
that
know.
Answer.
I
was still gonna. True. You're just making excuses.
I am. I am.
But anyway, 180 minutes, 3 hours for a maze. That's most people's whole night. Right. So yeah, I think that the event is being oversold. I mean, hey, I can't blame them. They need to make money, and I bet Horror Nights is a huge money maker for the Universal theme park. How could it not be? But I will say, the mazes were among the best that I've ever experienced throughout all my years of going to Universal since I moved here in 2005 when we started going.
Yeah, they were really creative, and I got scared a lot, which doesn't always happen.
Yeah, and they're using new techniques in their mazes. I think it was the Exorcist the Believer maze. Or the Stranger Things maze, one of the two where they used the false wall. It was like a scrim.
Oh, yeah.
And it looked like just like an actual wall. But then when they hit it with a certain amount of light, that wall disappeared and you saw a scene with live actors through it. I love that. And I've seen Knott's do that for years. And it was nice to see that kind of being brought over and adapted by Universal too. Just added a whole new dimension. Any other favorite mazes that you had? I mean, Exorcist Believer was a really good maze.
Yeah, that was. I really loved Evil Dead Rise.
Oh, it was so good.
I love that movie, so it made sense that I would love
They did
that
a
maze.
Great job at recreating key scenes from that movie in really inventive ways, like involving the elevator.
Yeah.
Right? Like the elevator filling with blood and the person hanging down from, you know, being tied up with all the... What are they called? Cables in the elevator?
Yeah,
they did a great job at that. And then I loved being able to walk into the bedroom where they're listening to the incantation on the record players and the living room of the apartment, because these rooms were massive and they used the space so well to make you feel like you were right there in that apartment. They did. It was amazing.
It was really cool. I really enjoyed the Blumhouse prop exhibit.
Oh, yeah.
Which was part of a show.
Blumhouse behind the scenes in the Shrek Theater. Now the, is it Kung Fu Panda? Is that what's there?
I think so.
Yeah.
That was really cool to see they had like a life-size Megan doll, which if you look at it up close, it looks so realistic. And yeah,
it's the one they use in the movie, right?
Yeah, it was amazing.
The props from The Black Phone, Freaky, Happy Death Day. What else? I think that was it that they had. Oh, Five Nights at Freddy.
But yeah,
they had all the animatronics.
That was cool.
Yeah, built by the Henson people there. Yeah, that was really cool. And then they showed this little clip of Five Nights at Freddy in the theater and a clip of some of their other films. And then all these Megans came out and danced.
Yes.
And we were like hooting and hollering. It was awesome. I'm it was sure like really funny and terrorizing.
If you can't go, you can probably find on YouTube videos of it. It's really fun.
Yeah, it was awesome. What else did I like? I like that they have the Death Eaters walking around Hogsmeade now. They have the whole Harry Potter area open. It's really fun to see at night. Yeah, all the snow-capped buildings in that area and the shops and everything. And then to be able to go and ride the Harry Potter Forbidden Journey, one of the best dark rides ever created, is nice that they incorporate that now. And what else? There's another maze I wanted to shout out. Oh, the Chucky maze.
Yeah, that was incredible.
This is the first year, I believe the first year, where they actually used like an animatronic Chucky's instead of someone in a Chucky outfit or wearing a Chucky mask.
Yeah.
It was all animatronic Chucky's, and they were working with, for the most part, live actors being killed.
Yeah.
And that was phenomenal.
It was really exciting because I felt like I was in the film because it wasn't just a person, like you said, walking around with a mask. It felt like a really possessed doll was right in front of me.
Holidays in Hell was also amazing.
Yes.
There was a lot of smells in that one, like Christmas and Easter. Smelled like candy.
Yeah.
And there was one where there was like a butcher. I don't know what it was, but like Scarlett or her daughter was like gagging.
Where was that?
It was part of that one, I think. Like someone was like cutting things or something. There was a kitchen scene.
Oh.
You know what one I didn't really like? And I mean, I'll probably get like skewered for this, is The Last of Us. I'm just not into The Last of Us. We've already talked about that. But hey, if you're listening, you might not have heard my rant about that show. It's just not my thing. And The Maze wasn't my thing either. But people who love the show love The Maze.
Right.
So there you go. Oh, I wanted to also mention, before we get off the Halloween Horror Nights thing, is in the Blumhouse thing where they have the prop displays. They have the two chairs from Exorcist Believer, which was really cool to see. If you've seen the trailer, you know these two chairs we're talking about, where the two girls are kind of side by back to back sitting on these chairs during the exorcism. So that movie comes out at time of release this Friday. I've totally forgot this. This is part of a trilogy. So the second one is already slated for 2025. That's Exorcist Deceiver. And there's going to be another one after that. I don't know if it follows the story of these two girls, if that continues or right. what the story is. But we'll see. We'll see. So go check that out this Friday. What are we doing? This weekend, we're going to do Knots.
Yeah.
I'm so stoked for Knots.
Me too.
They kill it every time. They're bringing back a maze that I really love, Grimoire.
Oh, that
which is kind of like their version of, because the interesting thing about Knott's is they don't have any IP to work with, meaning their mazes aren't based on existing movies. So
they have to be more creative.
Yeah, they're very creative in terms of inventing
new things,
their own thing. Yeah, a lot of ingenuity involved. And so this was kind of like their version of a Necronomicon thing, right? A demonic book that unleashes, you know, hell, basically, in a camp setting. So this one, you actually enter the maze through a tent. It's
crazy.
Such a cool illusion.
It's so crazy.
And part of it turns to black and white.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I get chills thinking about it. I can't wait to just immerse in that. So yeah, we're going to do that this weekend. And we'll tell you all about it. If you're in the LA area, that's something. If you're not in the LA area, you could live vicariously through us. And I'm sure there's walkthroughs now of every single maze on YouTube, which is great. And Delusion. We haven't done Delusion yet. That's an immersive theatrical experience in the LA area held at a historic mansion out in Pomona. And that's happening until November 12th. It's called Nocturnes and Nightmares. Each year is a different theme. And I believe this one's kind of like a remix of past experiences. So we're looking forward to check out that. Tickets range anywhere from $94 on weekdays to $155 for VIP on weekends. All right, let's bring that. It brings us to movies now.
That was a great segue.
Right? That was the clunkiest shit segue, actually. This is why I get the bad reviews.
Hey,
Mr. Radio Voice. I'm always told I sound like a cheesy DJ, so I didn't do any prep. So I sound like a very bad DJ, I guess.
You work in radio.
Yeah. I don't know how I ever got hired at a radio station. I clearly know nothing about what I'm doing. Oh, this podcast is proof. All right. Well, you exposed me to a movie that I had never heard of. And I love when this happens because I get to go in completely blind. Run from 2020 on Hulu.
Hulu.
Directed by Anish Chaganti, starring Sarah Paulson and Kiera Allen. It's about a girl named Chloe who's raised by her mom in complete isolation since she was born. But as a teenager, she's starting to explore her mother's secrets. Blew me away.
I was blown away,
too. I couldn't see where this is going. And the twists were incredible. And I was there for every minute of it. It started off super strong. I loved the woman who played Chloe, Kiera Allen. She was great. She had a lot of heavy lifting to do in this film. And Sarah Paulson, as usual, is just terrifying.
So the interesting thing about Kiera Allen is that she has used a wheelchair since 2014. And the filmmakers wanted to cast a disabled actress. And they thought that Hollywood doesn't always do that. And so they were really lucky to find her because she was so great. And they wanted it to be accurate.
Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Well, if you haven't seen this movie or heard of it, go check it out. I know we're kind of not telling you too much about the plot. But again, we want you to discover its secrets and enjoy the experience yourself. It's an awesome spooky season watch. Anything else to add about Run?
I don't want to give too much.
It's hard, right? It's hard
away.
To tell. Like, In one sense, I don't enjoy doing the movie conversations because it's a struggle not to give. Like, I don't like listening to movie conversations and people talking about movies that give away too much of even the plot, basically.
I'll say that I found out about this movie on social media. Like, I saw a clip and it was like, I wish that clip I hadn't seen because it had told me so much about the film. But because I did see that clip, I was like, ooh, this looks good. So I guess, like, I don't know, maybe it was a good marketing tool because it got me sucked in to pick it for us to watch. But at the same time, it was a big spoiler. And I'm not going to do that to you listening.
Another one you're going to want to check out, Nantashka Khan's Totally Killer. That comes out on Prime Video Friday. It is so damn fun.
Oh, I love it.
It is so good. So this is Kiernan Shipka, Olivia Holt, Julie Bowen, Liana Liberato from Scream 6, and a movie called The Beach House, which you should check out if you haven't already. Wow, what a blast.
It is crazy.
You can't go wrong with Sabrina Spellman, first of all.
That's true.
Kiernan Shipka is outstanding in everything
she's
in.
She can do no wrong.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's brutal. It's gory.
Yeah, I was surprised by how vicious and gory it was.
Yeah, it's just, you see it all many times.
Yeah. So it's a time-traveling slasher story where Kiernan plays Jamie, who accidentally travels to the 80s to team up with her teenage mom to take down a killer. And the mask is awesome. It kind of looks like Max Headroom. Do you remember Max Headroom?
Mm-mm.
I'm a little bit older than you, but Max Headroom was a big deal when I was a kid. Don't you remember? Like, he was like the face of Coca-Cola for a while. He was like a computer generated head in a TV with a bunch of different multicolored lines around him. And he would like stutter like, Max Headroom.
What did he do?
He was just like, I don't know, like a character. I forget where he was started, if it came before or after the Coca-Cola thing. I don't think he was created for selling Coca-Cola. He had his own TV show. Like, it was like a post-apocalyptic TV show. I believe it aired in Canada. I'm assuming it aired down here. I remember I was on a trip with my parents to the States, to Boston, and we stayed in this hotel and we were watching TV. And I don't know if it was a game, a football game or something, but somebody hacked the feed of the television network. Wow. And we're sitting in the hotel room with my parents and the game abruptly stops. And this person dressed as Max Headroom, very crudely filmed, like you can see, it looks like in their basement or something. It was an actor, just a guy with a rubber mask on of Max Headroom. And he was like throwing Coke cans and swearing and sticking his butt out and getting people to smack his butt. And I was like scared. I was like, what is it? My parents were like, what the hell? Because we're just little kids and it was inappropriate. I was like, what is this? And I was like traumatized by it. And you can look up this thing. I believe there's video so you creepy. Can still see on YouTube. It's very creepy. It's one of these things that I don't even know if they ever found out who did it. But they actually, some people hacked the satellite feed and put in whatever they were doing on this Max Headroom thing they were doing.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it was terrifying. If you remember that, DM us at Tales from the Boo Crew and let us know if you were as freaked out as I was, because I've carried that memory with me forever. But anyway, so the killer looks extra creepy because that mask looks exactly like the rubber Max Headroom mask that this guy is wearing, so they added like an earring.
Yeah, I like the earring. It's a nice detail.
Yeah, it's a very nice touch. Yeah, if you're a fan of Chris Landon in particular, freaky, happy death day to you, this is your jam. It's got that similar energy and viciousness, and it just scratches that fun Halloween itch.
I love it.
Yeah, it's a great one. So check that out. Brian Duffield's No One Will Save You on Hulu. You've heard us chat with Brian on a previous episode. You've seen this movie likely spread all over social media. Everybody's talking about it. If you haven't got on the bandwagon yet, definitely do so. It is extraordinary through and through. Very little to no dialogue. Incredible alien design by the folks at ADI, Tom Woodruff and his team, the Alien films, Predator. They know what they're doing, and it's very, very scary, especially in this era that we are right now, the disclosure era.
Yes.
And people like David Grush, former military and Secret Service people coming out, revealing secrets, alleged secrets, government secrets of alien cover-ups.
All the whistleblowers.
Yes. Which you are so into.
Oh my gosh.
Lauren is so into this.
I'm so obsessed.
It's pretty much all she talks about.
No, I talk about other stuff.
Yeah, but it's pretty much all. It always comes back to, you know, I wonder what Jeremy Corbell would think.
Oh my gosh. I say that a lot.
Yeah. We got to do another show with Jeremy Corbell. He's like the mega spokesperson of all this stuff too. We get so much information. It's so fun to follow his socials.
I get just so angry because I want to know the truth. Like, I am ready.
Yeah.
And I believe that there is something out there. I think that there's something here.
Mm-hmm.
And like 10 years ago, if I said that, I feel like a lot of people would think I was crazy, or I would actually be like, yeah, you're freaking nuts. But the government is telling us that there is unidentified objects that they have. They have biologics. You know, this is real. And I want to know, because I hear so many different theories and I don't know which are real.
It's hard to think, like, it's hard to accept. For me, it's hard to accept that all these people who are coming out, former military, why would they all be just raving lunatics and making things up like this? It just doesn't add up for me.
I don't know, but I do feel like somebody's got to be lying somewhere, because there are different.
All right, there's so many different theories, right?
And I'm just like, which one's real? And I just like, I get frustrated and angry because I'm like, why do certain people get to know? Like, why don't I get to know?
Yeah.
Like, we should all be able to know.
Tom DeLonge knows.
Yeah. I get so angry.
Right.
I just like.
No, I hear you.
I just want like 5 minutes and just be like, tell me.
Yeah, like off the record.
Yeah,
like, come
I'm
on,
not going to tell anybody. Yeah. Like,
what do you know?
I need to know.
Because if there obviously are. We've been told, and the government has has admitted there's stuff they're not showing us. Okay, well, if there's nothing to see, if there's no aliens, release all the footage. Show us everything. That's the weird thing, right? Because it's not. That's not the case. They're not showing us everything. You know, they won't even show, they won't even show a lot of these people who went to Congress.
Yeah.
What some of these videos where they wouldn't let them see it before their the hearings. So there's some, you know, there's something going on there. Why not? Right.
Yeah. I want to see, like, I want to know everything about them. And I just want to see, like, a real photo of, like, what they look like. Because then they're, you know, people are saying there's the reptilian aliens. And then there's the grays.
And those ones who look like us.
Yeah. Those creep me out the most.
Right.
The ones, because I'm like, wow, have I interacted with one and not even known? They're apparently a little bit taller than us.
Which is, like, that's creepy too, right? Because that means, like, they're like us, but they're a little off.
Yeah, that scares me.
Yeah, that's very scary.
It's scarier than an actual gray to me. Like, are they nice? How do we communicate with them? Yeah. How do they communicate with us?
Well, this movie really puts you in the position of what an invasion might really be like.
Right.
It just seems, as far as any movie I've seen that depicts an event like this, this feels like it would be the most accurate. And that makes it so scary. And we can't say enough good things about Caitlin Dever. She's phenomenal. One of the best performances of the year, bar none.
If you listening are obsessed with UAPs and figuring out, and you know stuff, or you think you know stuff, DM us. I will try.
Maybe you get some former military who listen to the show. They got secrets. They want, you could be the next Tom DeLong, Lauren.
Oh my gosh, I want to be in the next Tom DeLong so bad. And it has nothing to do with, like, I don't want to talk to him about him being in a band. I want to talk to him about aliens.
Right.
Like, I want to talk to David Grush. Like, I want to talk to all these people. I just want to talk about aliens.
Well, Tom's alien movie is coming out.
That's right.
This week, too. Monsters of California.
I want to see it. Looks fun.
Yeah, he directed it. The word is it's kind of like an Amblin feel, old school kid adventure alien movie that combines a lot of his knowledge and stories that he's heard over the years.
That is true. I feel like, remember that one episode where you kept saying outstanding?
Yeah.
I feel like I'm doing that with the word fun. I don't know why I keep
really
saying the word.
I haven't noticed.
Fun. Yeah. I'll
have to listen back to the tape. Maybe you say fun every second word. I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe it's like fun size because it's Halloween.
Yeah. There you go. Like, it's a fun size episode.
It is.
Well, there's a new Netflix doc that bounces right off Brian Duffield's No One Will Save You, and that's called Encounters. Steven Spielberg doc.
So good.
Which I didn't know. I didn't know Steven Spielberg was involved in this.
So there was this clip of him saying that, I believe I saw it a while ago, so I probably should have refreshed on this, but something like he thinks that these aliens that we're seeing are just us, but 5,000 years in the future, and we are coming back, or time traveling.
Is this is he into the, like, multi-dimensional,
I think,
interdimensional theories?
Which I have a hard time wrapping my brain around that they're here
in a different dimension.
Yeah, we just can't see that dimension.
And that Bigfoot exists in another dimension too, and can go back and forth between.
I'm just like, that's too crazy.
It's pretty wild, right?
Like that's ridiculous. But I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But to me, I was like, no. But
and do you think they travel through these dimensions in crafts, like spaceship looking things?
Well, what are all these things that everybody's seeing? These, like, spheres that are flying and they have no propulsion. And
so they made these vehicles that travel between dimensions. Yeah, it is weird to wrap your brain around. I can't.
To
picture them coming from outer space makes more sense, or under the water.
Right.
Makes more sense to me. But yeah, the interdimensional thing, I just can't wrap my brain around it. Maybe someone could explain it to me and I'd get it more. But
you could spend hours just thinking about all of this and not make any sense of it, because that's what I do a lot of the time.
Well, the documentary is cool because it's very recent and incorporates a lot of recent revelations like the gimbal and Tic Tac videos we saw them talking about. And that's kind of the backdrop to this series. That it's got unbelievable stories from high security intelligence officers. There's a naval cryptologist who pops on there, and a lot of sightings by civilians corroborated by mass amounts of people. There's one episode 4, which we haven't got to. It's a case, I think Leo was talking about this one. The episode 4 is called Believers, and it's 62 students in Zimbabwe. Remember this? We saw the trailer. They saw humanoid figures in their school playground back in the early 90s. And that sighting is called the most significant encounter of the 20th century. They had a Harvard doctor go out there as well to talk to the kids, because so many of them were traumatized by this alleged experience. So I'm looking forward to going down that rabbit hole. That case sounds particularly disturbing.
Yeah, I can't wait.
So we're looking forward to that. And, and to let you know, we should develop like a rating system where films and things that you see that you don't fall asleep in get a super high rating. Oh, like that's the max.
That's like the
100% Rotten Tomato rating. And you did not fall asleep, doze off, anything during run.
That's right.
And we watched that latest as shit, and you just fucking, you were with it the whole time. So that tells you anything. Yeah. I mean, it tells me a lot.
It tells me a lot. Sometimes I can't.
I get it. A lot of people feel the same way.
It's so horrible because sometimes I'm really into something and it's not that I don't like it or I'm bored. It's just like I can't control it. I just feel like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Eyelids get heavy. You have no control. Yeah. A lot of, and also you're relaxed.
Yeah.
You got your most relaxed. You're like, chill, put on a movie, boom, gone. Yeah. Yeah. There's memes about this. So it's, you're not the only one. But yeah, for what it's worth, Lauren stayed up through every single one of these.
That's crazy. That should tell you something.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've kept you long enough with our blabbing. So let's jump into our combo with Juan Salas to tell us all about his new film, House of Dolls. Right after this.
The Boo Crew will be right back.
The hills have eyes.
Locked. The old creep told you not to get off the road.
What began as a vacation ended as a nightmare.
Why are you doing this?
That was a bad mistake.
The hills have eyes. A night of terror. A day of vengeance where no one was spared.
Kill her, babe!
Kill me!
They fought back. Anything was a weapon. The family dog to the family car.
It's working!
The story of an American family who lost everything except the will to survive. The hills have eyes. They wanted to see something different, but something different saw them first.
Rated R. Under 17, not admitted without parents.
Onto the gurney for a Boo Crew autopsy.
Joining Bloody Disgusting's Boo Crew via the Speakeasy Studios, a talented and hardworking filmmaker whose early work went from making music videos for local Dallas artists before working with some of the biggest names in EDM, hip hop, and rap, including Grammy nominees Playin' Skillz and Rick Ross. He then made a handful of short films and features like the 5-time award winning The Wolf Catcher and earning Best Director for the documentary Mr. Lee, 20 Years of Power. By 2021's The Devil's Ring, he got a distribution deal with Gravitas Ventures, which catches you up to today. His latest adventure is an extremely wild horror slasher whose cast includes the iconic Dee Wallace and Miko Gattuso from A24's Euphoria. Three estranged sisters return home to collect an inheritance and end up in a gory, no-holds-barred bloodfest that would make Herschel Gordon Lewis happy inside of a giant pink frickin' dollhouse. All right, House of Dolls. It's on VOD, digital, and select theaters on October 3rd. We are honored to welcome its writer-director, Juan Salas. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me. Thank you for having me.
Man, of course. Thanks so much for hanging out with us and congrats on the film. We had such a great time with it. And you got to experience an audience experiencing that, right? You said that the premiere, the world premiere was in a theater in New York, right?
Yeah, last night in New York, we had the world premiere and it was insane. It was awesome.
Nice.
Hear the reactions, you know, it was definitely an experience. It was awesome.
Yeah. So that was any cast there, anybody part of the team get to experience it for the first time with an audience?
Yeah. Mico Gattuso stopped by. He did stop by to hang out with us. And the crowd loves him. You know, he's from New York. So, the crowd went wild for him. It was definitely an amazing experience.
Oh, that's amazing, man. What did you learn from watching that movie with an audience? Was there anything that stood out to you that maybe, you know, you didn't expect that an audience would react to in certain ways?
You know, it was definitely an experience, you know, especially from, you know, from a director's point of view, because I wasn't really watching the movie. I was watching the crowd.
Sure.
And, you know, seeing how they reacted and, it was so cool and it was surprising on some elements because I was like, I thought you would have seen that coming. And it was like, whoa. And I was like, okay, cool. So seeing it with the crowd was definitely an experience. It was definitely amazing with this first crowd. It was sold out last night in New York and tomorrow night we're sold out in Dallas, Texas, my hometown. And then LA, October the 3rd. So one after another, I can't wait to see how people react to it, you know, in general.
So we'll start at the beginning. Just go back a bit to your formative years. What was your earliest memory of being exposed to the horror genre and how did it make you feel?
Oh God, Chucky. I was traumatized for years. I was traumatized for years. You know, the 80s, it's very practical with all their stuff, you know, and I'm like three. So I see Chucky coming out of like Chucky 2 coming out the classroom like, hey, man, I was like, holy shit. I could not watch a horror movie for a while. I'm talking about 10 years probably. That was my dad got me to watch it. And then I remember him taking me to go watch Chucky Child's Play 3 in the theater. So I don't know why I went back, but that was my earliest experience with horror, you know. And of course, then into the 90s, I was a little older. And, you know, I became a huge fan, of course, Scream, I Know What You Did Last Summer, Urban Legend. But my first exposure was definitely Chucky. I won't forget that.
That's a great one, too, because especially as a kid, I can't really think of another horror movie besides maybe like Elm Street or something that really captures like the magic of cinema, bringing this doll to life in ways that as a kid, you probably couldn't even wrap your brain around.
No. It was traumatizing. I'm telling you, I think a lot of people came out of that a little.
Oh, yeah. We've got some good creators out of that, you included, man. So, but that said, I think it's pretty obvious that you are a huge cinephile yourself. I'm curious, what are some of the filmmakers who have inspired you along your journey? And is there any common thread that they all have in common that has kind of ended up in your own style and aesthetic because of your appreciation for it?
You know, I think everyone... You know, Steven Spielberg, you know, that sets everyone off. You know, seeing a dinosaur on the screen, that was amazing. As far as horror and inspiration, as I got older and into film, I started realizing who's making these movies and why and so on. I think, you know, it's very granted. Wes Craven was always a part there because I remember the People Under the Stairs. I used to watch that, The Hills Have Eyes with Dee Wallace. And then he went on to make Nightmare on Elm Street and then Scream. Wes Craven has always been there. And I didn't connect it till later with his movies. So that was always an influence. As I got older, I think Darren Aronofsky really stuck, especially with Requiem for a Dream. Now, I know it's not a horror movie, but it was horrifying. Once you got into it, I was like, holy shit. And then following his work with Black Swan, that was very, you know, I follow his work a lot. I love the grittiness of it. Like Black Swan. Oh my God. Black Swan. That was the first time I had a panic attack in the theater.
Oh, that's
in the
great.
Middle of it, you know, when it went crazy, I was like, holy shit. And I was like, what is happening? And man, I don't even want to talk about Mother because that one was amazing pieces of work, but he gets it out of you. But Black Swan, I don't know if you considered it a horror, but it was horrifying, you know, when she started going crazy in the room and I was like, oh my God, I started having a panic attack. I said, I need to take a second. So I had to get myself together for a moment, but Darren Aronofsky definitely stuck as a director. Of course, David Fincher, anything Fincher does, you know, amazing work. Those two artists, I would say definitely. Of course, Alfonso Cuarón, he does incredible work. But if anything, I think Darren Aronofsky, his work is definitely incredible. I always watch all his stuff for sure.
Yeah. Are there any particular slasher films that inspired you to write and direct this film?
Yeah. You know, again, in the 90s slashers, they were particular because they weren't as practical or explicit as the 80s. You know, you have Scream, you have I Know What You Did Last Summer, Urban Legend. I grew up on those, and those were very inspiring. And I think it was until I saw the remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the one with Jessica Biel.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to make a horror movie, because the 90s were, you know, they were 90s. But once we went into that era of the 2000s, there were more music video. They looked like very polished. Texas Chainsaw, the remake, was very polished. So, man, I just loved that movie. I loved it. And I was just like, you know what? I want to make my own slasher one day. So I was always planning it, even though I went off to do like four indies that weren't hard. One of them was kind of, I always wanted to do a slasher, but I would say Texas Chainsaw, the remake, it was, it really caught my attention. Of course, the original was a classic, you know, that's a classic. And, but you know, in the mid 2000s, you know, they had that, and then they remade Friday the 13th, very polished pieces of work. And then, you know, now you come into your, you know, your elevated horror. So watching horror change and grow has been amazing. But as far as slashers, to answer your question, I think it's a given Scream is my favorite. You know, being in the mid 90s, you know, Scream was, when it came out in the 90s, I mean, you knew it was everywhere. It was everywhere. It was amazing. It was all people talked about. So I can definitely say that the Scream franchise is probably my favorite slashers.
Mm.
For sure.
With all the movies that they were referencing, when you saw that movie at the time, when you saw Scream, were you familiar at the time with a lot of the movies they were talking about? Or did that movie inspire you to go back and see a lot of those too?
You know what? As a film, you know, growing up like that, I started noticing some of the references and I was having fun with it. That was the beauty of the Scream movies, is that you could have fun with it and it didn't have to be so explicit, so to say, you know what I mean? And, you know, when you watch House of Dolls, my current movie, you'll probably see, you know, inspirations here and there, as far as you don't need to be so explicit with it, but other than have a great time with it. And that's what was Scream, was the references. I caught those and I was like, great, you want to go back and watch it? You know, with Randy, especially the Randy character.
Yeah.
You know, going on to Scream 2, I think Scream 2 was definitely engaging. I think that was the best one out of all of them, because I'm not saying it followed the standard ropes, but you get there in a different way. You know, a lot of horror movies, there's so many horror movies, but it's how you get there. And Scream 2, yeah, they're fun movies. They're very fun for sure.
Yeah. I want to rewind a little bit too, just, you know, talking about yourself, seeing Chucky as a kid and growing up, just loving cinema and the filmmaking process. What steps did you take for you yourself to get involved in this? What was the first time you picked up a camera, or the first time you tried something yourself?
Right on. So I'll tell you this one funny story. It was a funny story. When the one time I tried to get a camera, I was a kid. They were selling them at McDonald's, right? A camera. Come on, I'm a kid. Oh, this is going to work. This is going to be great. I get the toy and it's like, it doesn't work.
Of course not.
Oh, man. I can't record anything. So like 10 years later, 15 years later, I decided to sign up to the Art Institute of Dallas. And that was my first exposure to like media and the camera. I was terrified of the camera, but you know, the Art Institute of Dallas showed me a lot of great teachers and professionals that worked in the industry. So that was my exposure right there to it, you know, to pursue it. And from there, I didn't, you know, it's a dream to make a movie for everyone. But you know, once you get in the mix of it, I got kind of thrown into music videos. Mm-hmm. And I think there is where I started kind of building a sort of polish to where I would be going, things like that.
Got it. So you mentioned like on your path leading up to House of Dolls, you have dipped your toe in the genre before a little bit. You co-produced that movie, Hell of a Night, and you wrote and directed the Sleep Paralysis movie, Alp, in 2015. So what do you enjoy about telling a story through the lens of horror that hits just a little bit different?
You know what I like about horror is that there's an audience for everything and you can kind of do anything. You know, with drama, you got to stick to drama. With comedy, you got to stick to comedy. With horror, there's everything for, and it could be anything for anyone. and you can make mistakes. You can go at it. You know, I think that's the beauty of it. And you see people like James Wan, how he came out with Saw, and then he went on to The Conjuring. It's like, wow. So definitely along those lines.
Right, sure. Right. Well, right here, man, we got this incredibly unique movie centered around this house and these three girls. What were the first ideas and images that kind of came into your mind to inspire this, the whole inception of this idea?
You know, it's kind of another funny story. So with each of my movies, I want to tell a story before I tell what it's actually about.
Yeah.
You know, it's important to tell a story. So the funny thing is, one day me and my sisters, three sisters, were arguing about an inheritance. And I was like,
sounds familiar.
I left and I started writing a script. And that's where it came about. And then I was filming The Devil's Ring. Finishing The Devil's Ring in Los Angeles, and I came across this dollhouse set, and I was like, let me just go check it out. I went to go check it out. We just did some test footage. I didn't know what I wanted to do exactly, but I knew the story was there. And I thought, you know, things just kind of rolled from there, basically. I wanted to tell a very human story with the backdrop, and then horror just came into it. When I found this dollhouse, I was like, wow, this would be amazing to take people out in, you know.
Wow. So you had already started the script idea, the concept before you saw the actual dollhouse set.
Yeah,
idea.
I just knew that I needed a cool backdrop that hasn't been really seen, and that's what played into that. Yeah, but first and foremost was a story. Have a good story.
Interesting. So okay, going a bit ahead to the dollhouse itself. So the exterior of the house and the interior, those two completely different things?
Oh no, it's actually a house. A lot
really
of people, use it. The Backstreet Boys film there. It's a pretty cool, popular spot in LA.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah. But there's definitely additions that I added, like a basement, things like that.
Yeah.
That probably weren't in the house. Yeah.
Got it. So in that process, like once you got inspired by, you know, you took the idea of the story to this basically location and you had that location in mind, how did the location influence the rest of the writing?
Well, I think it just complemented it. You know, it's about three sisters, a pink house, you know, so it was there and it was more so about the human interaction.
Right.
The set pieces definitely complemented it. The, you know, something's not right. You know, when you walk in there, look, it's a giant dollhouse, basically like a Barbie. So
yeah,
it started throwing things around. And that's actually what made the killer. Cause the killer, I knew he was going to be a killer. I just didn't know how he was going to look yet.
Right.
You know? And when I saw the house, then things started just rolling and pink became a theme. I'm like, okay, well, he's going to have a pink mask, you know? And then when you watch this movie, you kind of see it. But the house very much influenced the story of it and really flourished it for me. And it was an awesome experience for sure.
Wow. So designing that mask and everything, it's a really cool design. Anyone who hasn't seen the poster, Google it. Look at the poster. It's very striking. You haven't seen a slasher quite like this before. It's kind of got like a balaclava. There's spikes all over it. The character can bash people with his head. There's all sorts of things. He's got like an S&M kind of jacket. Well, take us through like the actual design of the, when you get down and dirty, the conceptual design of the exact look. Like who helped you or did you do it yourself? And
oh, wow. Yeah. Tatiana, she's our special FX artist. She did all the gore for it.
Oh, wow.
So we wanted to make something that would, you know, catch your attention. A lot of, you know, there's a lot of slashers these days and it's always what a guy in a suit and a mask, right? I mean, I love horror. Those are the basics. You know, that's where John Carpenter started with Halloween. So we knew it'd be along those lines. And we went through about four different outfits till we finally got to that one. And again, the house was really influencing me and I knew, okay, well, pink could be something. And I started thinking, like, who is this guy? What is this guy? And as you see the movie, you'll see traits that will kind of give you a hint as to why he did that. Mm. It was definitely a fun creative process with me and Tatiana. You know, a lot of trial and error of what's going to work, what's not going to work. But I am very happy of where it did end because it's like a rock. He's like a rocker, you know, he's like a rocker. He has spikes and stuff.
Yeah.
So I would say the house very much influenced into that. And I just knew how to go dark with it. So it really just came about. Oh, and actually, I was like, if I was a killer, where would I go buy a mask? You know, because I was trying to figure out how to make one. I was like, I need to go make one. Like, what's he going to do? So the only thing accessible thing was like a ski mask, right?
Yeah.
At every store. I'm like, if you're a killer, where are you going to go? You're not going to order online or something. So I'm like, you're probably going to go to a store. So there's a ski mask, and I was going to get a black one. Now, like everyone uses. And then I was like, there goes a pink one right there. And I was like, okay, cool. So we grabbed that. And I was like, it needs something, you know? And again, I just figured we got to go dark with it. So the whole rock star image just came to mind.
Mm.
And that's how it just rolled up. And I just thought, this will look great.
I also like how the mask maintains the continuity of what's going on in the story, too. He wears the different things that happen. They're on his mask. Yeah. They're on his outfit for the whole film, and it increases and changes throughout the movie.
Oh, yeah,
and you maintain that. Yeah, I wanted to talk about that because, yeah, you maintain it throughout.
Oh, shit. It was hell. It was hell. And then, you know, working on a budget, too. We don't have a bunch of masks. Yeah. We had to shoot Lanier because they're tedious to design. And then, but yeah, it was tedious, and we had to stick to it as much as possible. But that was the idea. In the progression of the film, you see how angry he is, and hopefully that'll showcase in his face. You know, you're seeing how much blood he's going through.
Yeah.
So that was the idea with that. And that's how we went about that.
And talking about the blood, I mean, the blood looks fantastic. He's got a really unique look to it, too. And there's a lot of it, dude. There's like disembowelments. There's all sorts of stuff. It's a real straight up like late 70s style gore.
We had to go practical with it. I mean, there was no other choice. There's no other choice. And, you know, we had to just get in there. And I think it was the best way to go. One of my favorite practical horror movies recently was the New Evil Dead remake. Remember that one?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
It's amazing.
Horror, practical effects in that. It was all practical. I went back and watched it, and it is as crazy as it was. It is so brutal as it was when I back watched it. I think it's one of the best remakes.
Oh, I'm totally practical there with you. Yes.
Yeah. Feel the practical effects. When the girl's pulling the glass out, you hear it. I'm like, oh, my God, it is so brutal. I wish to go that route eventually. It's like Alexander Aja, you know, The Hills Have Eyes remake.
Yep, right? Yep.
He does incredible, you know, work. But I think it's important because it makes it more real when it's practical. Me and Dee Wallace were actually talking about it when I picked her from the airport for the set. We were talking about, you know, practical effects and stuff. And she was telling me all about Cujo.
Oh, man.
And I'll tell you more about that in a second. But I had to go practical with it. That was a given. I think it was the best choice. There was no other way to go. But yeah.
Yeah. What was the most challenging gore scene in the film?
Probably the chainsaw scene. That was definitely difficult. Because we had to do that twice, and then it has to look right. You know, if it's not going to help us, I'm not going to use it. You know, not a lot, but you see certain things and you do the best what you can. And I reached a little far there. I mean, I know, you know, and then we're independent, so we don't have special effects. We have to be safe. So, you know, especially with the chainsaw. So we were very careful with everything and we did as much as we could, but I'm glad with where we ended up.
I wanted to know, just going back to the writing again, writing in kind of the female voice, right? Through the avatars of these three women and the grandmother, was there any challenges of doing that, or how did you approach that?
Yeah. So I wrote the story, but I hired a script writer. Her name is Eve. And once I wrote the story, I knew that I was going to need a female perspective.
Mm.
I was going to bring the action, but I needed the female voice, and I hired her. She's a very talented script writer. Amazing. And the script she wrote was incredible. She wrote, you know, perspectives that I probably wouldn't have just came up off the dot.
Sure.
And her words definitely brought meaning to each character, I believe. So I'm really happy with what she did with the script.
Mm, sure. Yeah, no, that's a really unique, like, yeah, that thread of family drama woven into this thing is a really unique take. And it also is reflected in the score, too, because that lets the composer go and do these sweeping strings and really emotional music and then into the horror. And then I think, you know, a big hip hop influence, you know, crams in there, too, which is a really cool flavor.
Yeah. You know, given my music video background, I always wanted to see someone get taken out to a hip hop song. So that was cool. Yeah. Then we did a music video to it. So that kind of helped out.
Yeah.
But it's definitely has shades of my past work, you know, everything I've done up until and of who I am. I definitely want to inject that into to give it its own identity.
Yeah, you have a great cast in this movie, man, with Dee and Miko and Stephanie and Alicia. But I was curious, how did horror icon Dee Wallace get attached to this film?
Okay, yeah, with Dee. So, you know, my previous film, I worked with Damian Chapa from Street Fighter. Mm-hmm. He was in my boxing movie, The Devil's Ring. That was an opportunity that came across. And then I saw that Dee was, there was an opportunity and I had to go for it. I didn't know if she would. And I sent her the script to her agent and they liked it. She liked it. When they responded, I was like, oh, okay, great. And I got on the phone with her. She liked the script. And that's how that rolled about. And working with Dee, man, that was incredible, an incredible experience, you know, especially given who she was. I was bombarding her with questions, especially I was the one to pick her up at the airport. I had to make sure everything was perfect. So I got to pick her up and I got to ask her all these questions about The Hills Have Eyes and about Wes Craven, about Cujo. And she's such a sweet lady. It was amazing to work with her. She told me all these stories. So I got to hang out with her for the whole day. It was amazing to work with, and especially seeing her work. I went back to watch Cujo, and I didn't realize how intense it is, especially because I saw it when I was a teenager. Okay, crazy dog. But I watch it now as a parent and it's a whole different take. It's like a whole different thing. And it was like, holy shit. So she got to tell me about all that and how the filming experience was intense. And I believe her because for our filming, she did not back down of anything. She did a lot of everything, the action.
Oh, that's great.
And she was like, no, I'm doing this. I'm running this. I'm doing that. And so it was awesome to see her at work and to work with a professional like that. It was definitely an experience I won't forget for sure, working with Dee Wallace.
And then you got Miko, who's he's a fascinating guy outside of his acting, right? And he brings so much, he brings so much of that to his acting too. And he gets to play this police officer, which is awesome. What do you love about him as a person, man? What have you learned about him? God,
Miko has been with me all the way. He's going with us. You know, he was with us last night in New York, tomorrow in Dallas and LA. He's a big part of this. He's very excited. When I approached him, I wanted to give him something different because I saw Euphoria. You know, he has all the tats.
Yeah.
So my thing with every actor is I want to challenge them. I want you to do something different that you wouldn't expect. He played a thug over here. Well, now you're going to be a cop.
Yeah.
He's like, how am I going to do that? And the first day we put the makeup on him as a test run, he was just surprised. He was on the mirror for a while. Because you know, he's had the tats forever.
Yeah, talk about a makeup job, man, right?
Yeah, he right when that happened, he put the suit on and he was like, let's go. He was super excited and he brought that element to it. And we couldn't be more happy to work with him. He's such a genuine person. Like, he goes out of his way to make sure that the mission is getting accomplished. And I couldn't appreciate that more. You know, me being independent, you know, he doesn't have to be doing all this, but he is like, he's on the team. You know, he's rocking with this. And we were very appreciative of him.
And the rest of the cast, too, did a phenomenal job. You've got Alicia Underwood and Taylor Cox and Naomi Lopez. They're the three central women, and they each play such wildly different people. Tell us about the process of finding them and where they're from.
So Taylor and Alicia are from L.A. Naomi is from Texas. The funny story with Alicia is that we were casting for the Charlotte character.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first character we were casting for. And we found Alicia and she sent her her audition. The crazy thing is that the first phone call I gave her a phone call to let her know she didn't get the part.
Oh, no.
And I said, I'm sorry, you didn't get the part. But you did such an amazing job that, you know, we're going to hold your audition off. And then I had talked to her for like 5 months. So she was probably like, man, I didn't get the part or nothing. And then situations happened and we casted Charlotte. And then there was this new character and her talent was just so amazing that I knew she could do anything. Like actors, you know, when you give them something, it's what they do with it. Not so much as what I have to keep telling you to do. I want to see variation. I want to see what you're bringing to it. And that's what she did. So when I called her back, I'm like, hey, she was surprised. I'm like, what's up? I said, so check this out. I told you we kept your audition on the side, and now there's this role. It's actually the lead role. And then she was like, oh, wow. Okay. So that's how that played about. It was fun. It was kind of crazy. And with the other actors, they were all amazing. And we had for each part, they definitely brought the personality. You know, for example, with Taylor's character, Helen, the very motherly older sister, you know, it's kind of like siblings, you know, mm-hmm. the older bro, you have the older sibling, the middle sibling who's always off the wire.
Yeah.
And then you have the younger sibling who learns from these two. So very much a family dynamic. I let those traits kind of start to define them, you know, with, you know, Helen first, the older motherly one, the caring one. Then you have Charlotte, who's kind of off the wire. The middle child always does what they want. Then you have the younger sibling who learns from this, and you know they're going to do a little better.
Yeah.
So into that, we gave them each their own personality, and I think they really brought it. They brought it home with that.
Oh, certainly. And, as a father of four, I can completely vouch for that family dynamic too. Yeah. That's how it is, man. That's how it is with kids.
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted if people to connect with it for whatever. You know, whatever you see, you know, it's very subjective. You know, it could be, you know, it could be funny one day. It could be nostalgic. It could be scary. It could be many things. And I think that's the beauty of horror movies. You can do whatever you want. But at the end of the day with me, I wanted to tell a story and then bring the rest in.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The actors, they brought it. I think each one definitely brought each character to life.
And then you throw all that in the most surreal backdrop ever with the most crazy looking killer.
And you just throw it in the blender.
Yeah, man, it's awesome. You know? I wanted to say that is it Jack Rain who plays Justin? Hilarious.
Jack Rain, man.
Hilarious. He's badass, man. I was curious, like, was any of his comedic stuff just him? Like, it seemed so natural and organic. Was he just off the cuff for a lot of that stuff?
I let him go off the rails.
Yeah.
Man. He was very constricted, but I was like, just go with it. I threw some of the actors. I was like, what is he doing?
Yeah.
He was just like, that's who he is. And we had a lot of fun with that, especially. And I just let him do his thing. I love it when it's natural. And he's a comedian as well. So I knew he had that in him. And I let him just run with it. So we picked the best parts of it, but without derailing what the main point was.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Jack is an amazing actor. He really brought it in. It was fun to work with him all the way through. This whole project was really fun to work with.
I want to talk about just the look of the whole thing, too, the way it's filmed. What ways has your involvement and love of music and music culture crept into your style as a feature film director?
Yeah, for sure. The visual, you know, music videos are very visual. So I think that's just implanted into my DNA. It needs to look amazing. You know, when you saw the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, they had amazing visuals, very cinematic, that set it apart from a lot of horror films at the time. Given the budget, it was very cinematic. So, and then again, circling back to the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the reason it really struck with me, because it was very polished like a music video. So I think music videos are definitely in my DNA. And then the hip hop element, given, you know, my background, I think it really just brings my own identity to each project. And that's important to me because we don't want to be like anything else. And I think just being true to yourself for the most part, will bring you where you want to be, hopefully.
Yeah. In terms of the set decoration, I was curious about the interiors of that pink house. Was a lot of that your guys decorating brought in, aside from the photos, of course, and the, you know, Or was the house as is?
The artist of the house, she's an artist, the owner of the house. She rents it out. Like, again, she let the Backstreet Boys use it. There's a lot of photo shoots, like for Maxim, things like that. So she does a lot of different things. So I let her already, it was already kind of designed, and then she just blemished it more just to add things to it. So she did incredible with her design, and we got to really utilize it to, you know, for us, and details that she didn't really highlight yet. So the set design really came from her. She did incredible.
Mm. And that set design kind of follows the other characters in their worlds too, and speaks on where they're coming from. Like Charlotte's room, for instance, or her apartment, wherever that is, with the neon writing on the wall. Like, it's very Charlotte, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah, outside of the house. Yeah. We wanted, you know, when they're in their elements, we wanted it to very much complement the character. So we definitely placed them as much as we could in their environment. Very different environments.
Yeah.
When you see them come together, they just, you know, they clash.
Exactly. Style.
And that's what was appealing to us in an emotional story, is to tell something that's, you know, a little different and you can connect to on a sibling level.
Yeah. And again, with the look, there's times in this movie when you experiment with color, like, you know, shoot it all in blue or reds and all these cool tones. Oh, what do you like about the effect that gives an audience?
Yeah. You know, we wanted to be sure that the story was being told visually too. You know, things are going okay, but things can go very wrong. And with that, that's how we got proceeding, is to let the visual tell the story. It's very pink for a little bit, but then it goes, you know, blue when all the action comes in and the killer's taking over. You know he's here. And then, of course, when they exit the house, they're out of that colorful craziness, you know. But that was the story. The idea is to let the visual tell the story.
Yeah.
With those colors and things like that.
Is there a kill scene or a sequence that you couldn't film due to budget or time constraints?
I think we got most of what we wanted. Of course, if we had a budget, we could do way more. You know, being an independent film, you know, you have a certain amount of time to get certain things done. You can't keep doing things over and over. So you really have like one shot. And hopefully if we get a sequel, I can really do some damage. You know, that's always helpful, you know, having that type of backing. But I think where we're at, you know, forced us to be creative. And I think that's even, you know, even better. But of course, some cool things I wanted to do. I filmed some stuff, but I had to take it out. I was like, I gotta do this a different way. Because I wanted it to be effective. But I have I have so many ideas that hopefully, however things play out, we can bring it on to the sequel if it plays out.
Do you have any story concepts for the sequel yet? If there should be one?
Yeah, we have a script ready to go for part two. Yeah, we have a script ready to go. I'm hoping it can really play out. Again, our crew was amazing. Our actors were amazing. It would definitely be a dream, but we definitely have a story ready to go.
Was there ever a name really for the killer? Did you guys call the killer anything on set?
You know what? We have a name for him. We call him Dollface. But again, my thing with the whole concept is that, you know, he's a killer. He's not going to tell you his name.
Yeah.
You probably won't even know it till the sequel.
Right.
You know,
it's like Leatherface, you know, right? We didn't call him Leatherface in the first Texas Chainsaw.
Or Jason. I don't think he was even, his visual wasn't in the
first exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, you won't really know who they are until the next one. So there's definitely a bigger story at hand. And what you're seeing is the middle piece of the puzzle.
There's definitely
a big backstory to it. And there's definitely an ongoing story. For sure. But we're all really excited where we are now and the reaction we get. So wherever we go, we're very happy with it, and anything else would be a blessing.
Sure. That's so cool. Did you end up keeping the costume, or did anyone walk away with that thing?
I have it.
Awesome. That's gotta be a new Halloween costume, man. People gotta start cosplaying.
I don't want to talk too soon, but that's already in the works. Oh. We have a costume ready to go for next year.
Hell yeah, man.
So, depending how everything plays out, you know, we're really excited and we're happy with the reaction. So, you know, we don't want to think too far ahead, but for the moment, we're definitely happy with everything that's happening.
Yeah, dude. Well, that's the big dream for any horror filmmaker, man. Have one of their characters become a Halloween costume, man. It's exciting that you guys are thinking about that. I mean, it is something, man. I would rock that thing, man. It looks cool as hell.
Yeah. We all had a great time again. It was a very fun project to work on from beginning to end. It was nonstop action, you know. Trying to make the shot work, all the blood, it was so much blood everywhere, like getting stained, and it was so much fun. We had to be very creative. We were all challenged creatively. If one thing doesn't work, how are you going to do it? You know, again, I filmed other other death scenes, and they didn't come out how I wanted. So I had to do it again in a different way, something that's effective. So the whole process was really fun to work through. And overall, we're very happy with it, where it ended up, for sure.
How much time did you give yourself to film?
We had to film it in the span of a year and a half.
Got it.
Because we're independent. I couldn't film like in a whole week. I would have loved to.
Yeah. So it's broken up.
We had to film one day. I had to save up, film another, Then we brought Dee Wallace in a couple of months later. Then we brought Miko in. And then, of course, the process of editing and polishing. We ended up in a good space. It's definitely a process, and it took me a span of about a year and a half. Naturally, a movie like that, you probably film about a week or two or something like that.
Sure, sure.
But given the circumstance, I'm very happy where we ended, for sure.
Yeah. So now you get to sit back and kind of hand it over to an audience, right? And like, you know, watch it through their eyes. So what, you had this premiere in New York. So you got Dallas coming up, and then there's one. When's the one in L.A.?
One in LA is October 3rd, and that's actually for the digital release. It'll be available on digital on Vudu. You can actually pre-order now. But yes, our LA premiere is October 3rd, and can't wait to see the reactions. You know, it's each crowd is going to be different. You know, New York is loud; they're different. So LA, Dallas, I know they're all excited right now. And then to finish off in LA, it's going to be amazing. We're all excited. The actors are excited. The fans are excited. So we're just kind of taking it all in and seeing where it goes.
And then besides this, anything else you got cooking on?
No, right now the focus is this.
Yeah.
Again, the focus is this. Every movie is a learning experience. And going forward, whatever I do next, I know it has to be the next level, the next step. Whether it's a sequel to this or another horror movie. I have like five other scripts. You always got to have something in the tank, but what you go forward with just depends on the circumstance, the timing and all that. But there's definitely things I'm ready for, but we're living in the moment and we know we're taking it all in and seeing how the world embraces it. And, just all we can do is have fun with it. My main goal with this film was to have a film that you can enjoy. That's fun. And it's accessible was my thing. I would say, again, the 90s horror movies were it for me. So I'm a huge fanatic of the 90s. And again, in this movie, you'll recognize a couple of nostalgic things, a couple of funny things. You know, I'm a horror fan, a horror guy made it. So you're going to enjoy it, hopefully.
Well, before we go, I would just love if you got a recommend, if you could tell people besides seeing this movie, maybe one or two other horror recommendations that you would recommend everybody see if they haven't already.
And I'm gonna have to reach back to the 80s. If you haven't seen The People Under the Stairs with Wes Craven, that was an incredible movie. I think people need to go back and watch that because it's different. Wes Craven did amazing work. That's one movie I think people should go back and revisit. Another horror movie. I love slashers. Let me pick a slasher, random one. The Hills Have Eyes, the remake. With Alexander Aja. That's a brutal, great film. Brutal. I saw it recently.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, it's so badass, and his style. Those are two great horror movies I would recommend. Both, by Wes Craven, in a way,
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. I'll start with Wes Craven, both those. That's great, man.
Yeah.
That's great. Awesome one. Well, man, thank you so much for doing what you're doing, and congrats again on House of Dolls. And we can't wait to see what's on the way, man. And that was the Boot Crew Podcast, episode 403. Thanks to our guest, Juan Salas. Follow at Tales from the Boot Crew on Instagram. Production tracks for this episode provided by
our friends at Powerman 5000.
That's right. Anything to add before we take off here?
403. That's a lot of episodes.
That's a lot of episodes.
That's crazy. I feel like we should have a party or something. Or go to a parade. At our old house, there was a lady. And she was very strange. And she lived across the street. And she said that she would be willing to babysit Scarlett, who was very young at the time.
Yeah.
If Trevor and I ever wanted to go out or go to a parade.
That was her exact words, if we ever wanted to go to a parade.
And I was like, what?
Is there even a parade in Burbank? Remember there's floats that were by the police station or whatever?
Okay, but that's for the Rose Parade.
Is that the Rose Parade?
That's not here.
It's not even here. There is no parade here.
No.
Maybe she's talking about the Rose Parade.
Yeah. I guess.
Once a year, she'll watch Scarlett so we can go to the Rose Parade.
On New Year's Day.
Yeah. No wonder you sleep on the bleachers to be able to see the fucking thing instead of just watch it on TV.
I don't know. Maybe she was an alien.
Could be.
Who says that?
Could be. All right. Thanks for putting up with us. Till next time, from myself, Lauren, and Leo, who's not here. He's in Ireland. It's the Boot Crew saying...
sweet screams.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Boo Crew Podcast. Haunt the Boo Crew at TalesFromTheBooCrew.com. Tales from the Boo Crew on Facebook and Instagram. Follow us on Twitter at Tales from the Boo. The Boo Crew is Lauren and Trevor Shand and Leone D'Antonio. The Boo Crew is produced by Lauren Shand, chopped and sliced by Trevor Shand. The Boo Crew is a TSP creation, part of the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
Bye.
A Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network, home of the Boo Crew. For horror-centric interviews, SCP archives, weekly full cast storytelling, horror queers, genre commentary from an LGBTQ perspective, and creepy. For disturbing and terrifying creepypastas. Listen free wherever you stream audio and at bloodydisgusting.com/podcasts.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.